You remember how we started last Friday with how terrible this economy is? Yeah, so about that. Never mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, great to have you here, as it always is, everybody. 250,000 jobs. Tad more, actually. It was a BAFO unemployment report that we got this morning. So BAFO that we got to talk about it for a little bit and some other stuff as well. Neela Richardson is here. She's at Redfin. Sudeep Reddy is with The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Neela. So any word other than BAFO that you would care to use just to get that out of the way?
It was a really strong report, so I would say good.
All right,
good
BAFO.
Job, economy. Not as creative as your choice.
That's all right. Sudeep, thoughts?
Well, it was good, and you would have had to squint pretty hard in this jobs report to find something bad. There were people who were squinting this morning looking for something bad, and they had a very difficult time. It tells us that we've got good job growth, we've got good wage growth, and in the short term, we have an economy that's actually performing in a way that it needs to stay on a decent path. Our prospects in the longer run are a bit darker. We've talked about the weak economic growth, very weak productivity growth, pretty miserable business investment. All of those are factors that are problems that will show themselves in the longer run. So those are things we should be worrying about right now, but of course we're not worrying about them right now.
No, of course
the splinters that Sudeep mentioned, it's hard to square the good jobs numbers we've seen in the last 2 months with the fairly lousy GDP picture we saw in the first half of the year. That's the question going forward.
Exactly. So let me actually, Neela, continue with you. And this idea that I talked about with Felix last week and Catherine Rampell, I think. Maybe it was Lynette. I'm going to get in trouble over that. This idea of it's not a jobless recovery because we got jobs coming out our ears. What we're having is a growthless recovery, Neela. Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And it's because the consumer has rebound. The consumer is recovering. Even in this latest GDP report, you saw consumer spending, you know, keeping pace. What has not rebounded is business investment. That's still lacking. It's a one-sided recovery where consumers are doing all the work and the corporate America has yet to show up. And that's playing out in the productivity numbers. It's playing out in the GDP growth rate.
Yeah.
And it means that the economy can keep creating jobs and we see no macro payoff when it comes to economic growth.
Sudeep, that seems not sustainable, the idea that it's all on the consumers and nothing on corporate America.
It is not sustainable. History tells us that this is not a recipe for a strong economy in the long run. It may be that businesses did show up and they showed up in the early stages of the recovery and now they've gone home. That is a problem. It's not clear what brings them back out, what gets them spending and investing and seeing the cycle of positive indicators you need to actually generate the long run growth in jobs and GDP and everything else that you would need to deliver broad-based gains. And that's what we're talking about. That's what we've been talking about for a while.
Yeah,
we're talking about in the election, of course.
Neela, the thing that struck me about this report today was that we are doing fine, whereas the rest of the world, China certainly, and Europe maybe not so much. I mean, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England yesterday cut its rates for the first time since 2009. I mean, we're doing fine. The rest of the world is not. What are we to do with that?
It depends on how you view Europe. Do you view Europe as America's past or America's future? And that's the big question we still need to answer. The thing about Europe is that a lot of the political upheaval has been tied to fiscal austerity that has kept people in very dire situations in terms of employment and wage gains and a lot of other things. Now, if that's the direction or path that we will continue, that'll be decided in this political election, among other things, not just at the top of the ticket, but what the congressional makeup looks like going forward. That's the question we have to answer because it's really the fiscal guidance that's missing in the corporate growth story. We haven't seen it yet.
We haven't seen it for years, right? I mean, Sudeep, it's not like Congress has done anything great for the economy. And while I've got you, actually, Sudeep, talk to me for a second about who this benefits election-wise.
In a normal election year, this would clearly benefit the incumbent party. This is the precise moment when voters who are undecided are making their final judgments about the state of the economy. This is obviously one of the more bizarre election years we've had, where we're talking about the unique traits of a certain candidate. So it's become a referendum about something other than the economy, mm-hmm. increasingly, even though we had all this discussion about voters who have been left behind, people who have been hit economically, it is quickly morphing into something else. So the economy we have now is the economy voters will be picturing a little over 3 months from now.
Sudeep Reddy is at the Wall Street Journal. Neela Richardson is with Redfin. Have a good weekend, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street today was all over those jobs numbers in the best possible way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So we were talking, Neela and Sudeep and I, about this growthless recovery we're having. It's also been, by and large, a wageless recovery for a while now. And yeah, no, I know people are getting paid, but those wages have been stuck for years. Buried in today's jobs report, though, was a hint of wage growth. One data point does not a trend make, I know, but we can call it encouraging. From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
7 years into this recovery, workers are not just getting jobs. They're demanding raises and getting them. Wages rose a nice 2.6% the past year. And with low inflation, that's a real paycheck bump. And bosses, they have to pay up, says Bill Dunkelberg, economist at the National Federation of Independent Business.
We do see a tight labor market, and we see complaints about finding qualified labor at the highest level we've seen in this recovery period. You've got to pay more to attract the workers you want and to keep them.
To step back a second, workers the past generation have become more productive. Their bosses got richer but didn't give much back, says economist Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan. Now he says that elusive income growth is starting to show up.
We're finally getting it, and it's occurring at a reasonable clip, although it hasn't by any means made up for all the real wage gains people hadn't been getting over the previous couple of decades.
There are even positive signs for unskilled workers. Those are the easiest to replace with machines or foreign labor. And at the Conference Board, a business and research group, economist Gad Levinon sees a brightening picture for young workers. The recession hit them hard.
People in that age group were willing to take a job no matter what, so that led to a significant slowdown in their wages. But now it's becoming a more normal labor market situation for them.
Keep in mind, many workers are just entering normal. So for all the good news, wage growth has yet to catch up to levels pre-recession. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Donald Trump released the names of his economic advisory panel today. No women, a whole lot of white guys, most of whom don't fit the traditional political economic advisory team mold, namely being economists. Trump has gone with actual practitioners of market-based capitalism. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer took a look at how that might affect the candidate's economic policies.
There's a difference between businessmen and academic think tanky big picture economists, says Jared Bernstein.
Economic policy at the level of the White House is a completely different thing than Wall Street. You have to understand the nature of compromising with the other side. You have to know how budgets work.
Bernstein was chief economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Henrietta Traes is a macroeconomic policy analyst at Height Securities. She says businessmen are much more focused on turning a profit than on the economy as a whole. Whereas an economist might take in all a president's priorities, a businessman might put the economy over, say, immigration, and tell the president
and make infrastructure your number one priority above and beyond, for instance, building a wall between the United States and Mexico.
But Traes also worries about conflicts of interest among the businessmen advisors. What if an economic policy is the right thing to do, but would pinch their profits? Another person who'd like to see more economists on Trump's team, Michael Strain of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. But then again, he says,
the extent to which Mr. Trump is influenced by any of his circle of advisors, I think, is up in the air.
The Trump campaign says more names will be added to the list of economic advisors at, quote, later dates. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This has not been a good summer for Hollywood's big tentpole movies. I'm looking at you, Alice Through the Looking Glass and the BFG. And therein lies a big problem for theater owners, how to keep revenues up even as the number of people going to see those kinds of movies goes down. Part of the fix may involve a surprisingly small change where you put the candy. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that one.
If you're the parent of a toddler, you may know the feeling. You've invested a small fortune in movie tickets. You're headed for a blissful 2 hours in a dark theater. All you have to do is maneuver your kid past the racks of candy, now right within his tiny reach.
Candy! Candy!
Ricard Gill is a dad and a professor at Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. He describes the situation as only an economist could.
The minute that the kid sees the candy, we would say that the elasticity of demand of your son or your daughter basically drops like crazy.
That's econ speak for when a $5 box of Raisinets becomes a small price to avoid a Category 5 meltdown. Simply moving the candy out front also does a number on adults.
Having it in front of you reminds you that this is available and you just go ahead and do it.
And without ever having to say these words out loud or feel the shame of saying them, I'd like the Coke, the Junior Mints, and I think the Sour Patch Kids. Jack Oberleitner is a cinema consultant. He says removing the barriers
increases the volume of candy products and other impulse items that you're selling by as much as 50 to 90%.
50 to 90%. So why haven't more theaters gotten rid of the glass case?
Like everything else, it requires money.
Rearranging concession stands requires new shelves and signs and traffic patterns. And theaters are already spending on other concession experiments. Things like sushi, vegetable plates, smoothies, alcohol, and those expensive, semi-magical design-your-own soda machines.
The industry as a whole collects about between a fifth to a quarter of its total revenue from concessions.
That's Daryl Ulama, an analyst from Ibis World. He says for big theater chains like Regal and AMC,
now close to about a third of their overall revenue comes from concession sales.
Last quarter, both chains reported a 10%-ish drop in box office revenue. That's as concession spending per person was at record highs. But no amount of fancy food or candy placement manipulation matters if Hollywood can't figure out how to make movies people want to see. I'm Adrian Hill.
Candy!
For Marketplace.
Coming up.
Oh, I am so not a fan of flip-flops.
No strong feelings here either way. Your mileage may vary. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 191 points today, about 1%, closed at 18,543, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 54 points, 1%, 5221. The S&P 500 up 18 points, 0.8%, 2182. For the week, the Dow grew 0.6%, the S&P 500 up 0.4%, the NASDAQ advanced 1.1%. On the theory that a strong jobs report could help convince the Fed to raise interest rates, and higher interest rates are good for banks, financial institutions were on the upswing today. Wells Fargo secured 1.7%, Citigroup deposited 4.2%. In the delivery of stuff business, Amazon is launching its own branded cargo plane called Prime Air. Amazon up 0.6% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.59%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Amid the athletic performances, the medal presentations, the protests, and the celebrations down in Rio the next couple of weeks, there is also this. It is flat out expensive to host the Olympic Games. Rio's deficit is being estimated in the billions of dollars. Hasn't always been that way, though. David Goldblatt is the author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You know, a lot of people point to the L.A. Games of 1984 as the games that discovered the Olympics could turn a profit and it could be a money-making enterprise. I want to take you back, though, to 1936 and Berlin, which you say sort of changed the economics of the Olympic Games forever.
Well, it changes it because for the first time, you've got a national government prepared to open the coffers. And while, you know, it's difficult to calculate, I reckon in today's terms, Berlin costs something in the region of $10 billion. So that changes the scale of the games, the aspiration of the games, sort of lays down a gauntlet to everybody else in the future. So that's state funding. That's absolutely not the private sector model of LA 84.
Talk about that LA model, because the organizers there were actually barred legally from using public funds, and so they had to find other ways to do it.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Ueberroth is the key figure here. He turned out, tried for the 56 water polo team for the games for the States, but ended up founding the second biggest travel agency in the US. And there are three elements to making it work in LA. First of all, you don't build anything. You use what you've got. And you make the most of it. Second, you actually get a deal with the TV people that represents the real value of the games. And then there was sponsorship. And again, there'd been a lot of sponsorship at the Olympics by then. Lake Placid in 1980 had like 325 sponsors. But as Ueberroth said, what did you end up with? You know, a lifetime supply of chapsticks and yogurt. You know, what you needed was money. The problem is, no one has been able to repeat the feat.
Well, right. How did we get from there to today, when I think there are, what, two countries bidding for the 2024 games and there was some arm twisting involved to get them to bid?
Well, for the 2022, there were just two for the Winter Games, and we were down to, you know, Almaty in Kazakhstan and Beijing, which is like 180 kilometers from the nearest mountains. I mean, all sorts of things have changed. And the first thing that's changed is these days, the money that comes in from television and sponsorship doesn't go to the host. They're barely getting a penny of that. That's being recycled through the International Olympic Movement to the sports federations and the Olympic committees and so on. The hosts don't get a thing.
Were you surprised then when the residents of the city of Boston came down firmly on the, we want nothing to do with this bid for the 2024 Summer Games?
I was only surprised in the sense that finally common sense seems to be reigning in this world. And I thought, you know, good on Boston, because the arguments at the moment under the current model of Olympic funding and development just don't add up.
Let me get you back as we close then to this idea of Berlin in 1936 and why people want the games. It is a vessel. It is a means by which national power can be projected, even with all its flaws.
It is, and it is also a place where national power and where dominant stereotypes can be challenged. I mean, of course, Jesse Owens is the story we all know from 1936, where, you know, on the field of play, you know, racism and fascism could be, you know, challenged. And my favorite of all, the Indian hockey team who appeared, you know, under the flag of the British Empire, but in secret would take out the Indian flag of Congress before they went out on the pitch. Huh. And in the final, they beat the Germans, the Nazis, 8-1. And it's those moments of kind of transcendence and challenge to the order that show what, you know, what kind of humanity we really are. That's the last thing keeping, you know, keeping the eyes on the screen and giving me hope.
David Goldblatt, his book is called The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. Mr. Goldblatt, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you so much.
You might call them flip-flops. Others call them thongs. Way back in the day, apparently they were called go-aheads because it was so hard to walk backwards in them. By any name, though, I use flip-flops. They're pretty much the official shoes of summertime. If you live in California or Florida, it's the official shoes of a whole lot longer than that. Last year, Americans spent more than $2.5 billion on flip-flops. So, continuing with season two of our series, Summer, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
We put Marketplace's Rima Kreis on the trail of one of the world's oldest shoes.
This was a pretty tough assignment. I had to put on sunscreen and spend an entire afternoon at Venice Beach. That's where I found 29-year-old Travis Huber. He was staring out into the ocean, arms folded, standing guard over three pairs of rubber flip-flops. His friends.
And one's my girlfriend's who needs to go to the bathroom, so they're running out into the water.
After Huber's companions are done peeing in the ocean, I hit them with it. Do you know where flip-flops come from?
I do not know where flip-flops came from.
His girlfriend, Lauren Candela, has a theory.
People that were, like, lost at a desert island or some kind of cool jungle, and they wanted to protect their feet, because as soon as your feet get hurt, you're done.
Then, but when did the name flip-flop come to origin?
Good question, Huber. I'll come back to that in a bit. First, the beginning.
Well, they are probably the oldest form of footwear.
Tamara Lindsay is the founder of the Shoe College in Arizona. Yeah, that's a thing. She says flip-flops date back to ancient Egypt, you know, 4000 BC. But multiple cultures have put their own twist on the sandals. For example, instead of placing the strap after your big toe...
The Romans used the second toe, and the Mesopotamians the third toe.
Interesting. Okay, so what about the modern-day flip-flop? Elizabeth Semmelhack is the curator of the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto.
It's clear, to me at least, that it originated in Japan.
During World War II, Japan was big into rubber production. It took over rubber tree plantations across Southeast Asia.
And so obviously they lose the rubber regions after the war leaves, but the industry itself was still viable.
In the 1950s, Japan began shipping rubber flip-flops to the U.S. They were one of the earliest exports after the war, and they were called zoris, after Japanese thongs, typically made of straw.
It's interesting that Americans were willing to consume footwear that was so clearly linked to a recent enemy state.
Those early flip-flop adopters were mostly American housewives.
Who would wear a pair of rubber thongs in the shower, maybe puttering around the house.
Soon, children started wearing them. Cheap and cheerful, they quickly became a summer staple. Then, in the late 1990s, this humble poolside shoe became trendy. Havaianas, a Brazilian-based company, helped make that happen with splashy and sparkly styles. Marcio Mora is the U.S. president.
Our cheapest model sells for $18, and then we have all the way to above $100, right?
The global company produces about 220 million pairs of flip-flops a year. Diane Shader-Smith, a publicist, has her share. At her home in Los Angeles, she tours me through her impressive flip-flop collection. She's got more than 30.
Your shoes reflect your personality, and the flip-flop reflects mine.
Shader-Smith wears flip-flops every day. Every day. Basic ones to the stores, shinier ones for meetings with high-end clients, bejeweled flip-flops for weddings.
This is my most expensive pair. It's from Neiman Marcus. It's $400.
That's because of the pricey leather and abalone shells.
These are my cheapest pair. They were on sale for $15.
Shader-Smith says people often ask,
do you even own a pair of decent shoes?
Do you?
I actually have a lot of shoes upstairs I never wear, ever.
Oh, I am so not a fan of flip-flops.
That is Squid Vicious, or his online name anyway. He's from Oregon City and hates flip-flops so much that he felt compelled to create a Facebook group and website where haters can unite.
We've almost come together like a community.
He says it's the sound that irritates him most.
It's like in a scary movie when the music changes and you're like, okay, well, something bad's going to happen. It's like the flip-flop sound's just going to get closer and closer until eventually you see the suspect.
And that brings us back to Huber's question.
But when did the name flip-flop come to origin?
The term was coined in the 60s, and it was based, surprisingly enough, on that slapping sound only flip-flops can make. In Venice Beach, I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I don't think the International Olympic Committee understands the way the internet works. The social media rules for the games include this sentence, quote, "The use of Olympic material transformed into graphic animated formats such as animated GIFs or short video formats such as Vines and others is expressly prohibited," end of quote. First of all, yes, I said GIF, deal with it. But also, how are they going to stop it? All right, on a Friday afternoon, that is all we got. The Dow up 191 points today, 1%. The NASDAQ up 54 points, 1% there as well. The S&P 500 up 18 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizzo. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.